All right, we got another interview tonight on Metal Meltdown. I've got James Rivera from Hellstar and Dave Ellefson from that one band. We all know, I don't know who it is, but and he also has the EMP record, the EMP group label. How you doing, guys?
Good. What's happening?
How are you, Jeff?
All right. Yeah, we're gonna start out here. James, history of Hellstar. You guys, just got on with EMP and whatnot, but if you want to run down the history real quick?
We were pretty much aboard that first ship that came out during that underground metal scene back in, 82, 83. And, we our first album came out in 1984 on Combat Records, which was kind of a label that was, catering to that, to those kind of bands. And then, from there, we did two records with Combat, and then didn't do our first tour to the second record, which was Remnants of War. And that's when, I met Dave when we did some shows with Megadeth back then. And then from there, we got switched over to Metal Blade for two more records that kept the band going through like 1989. And then in the 90s, things kind of slowed down for us a little bit. And then 95 put out another record on a German label. And at that time I had ran into Dave again and he produced half the record, which we were going to just do a demo, but the label decided to put out a full record. And then that came out in 95 on Massacre. And the band went kind of silent for a while. And then around, early 2000, festival started kind of wanting the band to perform, so I had to put together, not, I hate to use the word artificial, Hellstar lineups, but they were all quality musicians. But so I kind of survived with that, and that's kind of what brought the whole band back to full swing again, was the fact that around 2000, if you remember well, then old school metal and that whole metal resurgence, it started hitting hard again, and yeah. Bands started becoming alive again. And so after that, several years passed, then I had an opportunity to work with the majority of the original members that actually toured with Megadeth in 86, which is the Remnants of War lineup. And that led to really big interest with AFM Records in Germany. And so we did a total of five records with them over an 8-year span. And so that ended. And then here I am now, and Dave's cradling me again. So what can I say? He can't get rid of me. He's like, God, that's that little Mexican stepson I have. I don't know what's up with that, that's trying to get it as brief as possible. And that's how all this happened again. And we just finished recording the new masterpiece called Vampiro. And I think that a lot of fans are going to be very, very, very happy, especially the old fans, because we basically recaptured the Nosferatu album, the whole vampire Dracula concept. But musically, it's even gone back to that somewhat. And although we're a much heavier band now, but we did incorporate a lot of that style again.
Excellent. Who is in Hellstar now?
Well, now it is me and Larry Berrigan. That's the whole thing. That's the real Hellstar, regardless. As long as me and him are together, that's fine. But and then we have Mikey Lewis on drums, who's been in the band now since The Glory of Chaos, which was three albums back. And he was also one of the guys I had doing shows with me when I was going under the name, just to get out there and do festivals. So he's been around in my life for quite a bit, for about 15 years now, off and on. And then we got these new two kids, Andrew Atwood and Garrick Smith, guitar player and bass player. And we started out with them, with Garrick actually joining first, and then Andrew came aboard later to fill in for Rob Trevino, who was in the Remnants of War original lineup for a while. And he got a lot of obligations with his job and family and stuff. So Andrew started filling in for shows. And since they were already doing my tribute act all together, we decided, well, these are perfect guys. And that's how they ended up in the band. And that's the lineup now.
Right on. Excellent. So the opportunity of coming to EMP, can you give us some more detail on this most recent thing with David?
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, I didn't really. So, I mean, it really all goes to credit to, you know, Joe Troutman, a good friend of ours, that, you know, Dave was the one that married them, him and his wife. And so we all went out for the wedding. So we were already there. But I had been talking to him about, you know, what my plans were for the next record. And he, you know, and we were almost just going to do our own label thing. You know, that was just because of the way things were going. And I said, we're probably better, you know, because nowadays everybody's got their own studios and it's much easier to do all that stuff now. And he's the one that said, dude, well, you know, Dave started a label. And I was like, oh. And then he was like, yeah, I had no idea. So, you know, I was like, well, shoot. He was like, let me call him. And I guess once he talked to Dave, and I think, you know, as the way it was presented to Dave, it made sense for everybody. And I mean, it happened that quick. I mean, it wasn't even something to even think about. You know, Dave didn't even go, oh, well, let me hear their demos. Let me see what they're doing. He's going, you know, okay, these guys have been around since the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I'm sure they can write some decent songs. So, you know, and it happened so quick that it was just like, wow, you know, it was almost so real. And that's basically how it happened.
David.
Yes.
Question for you, if you want to get into a little bit more about how you guys met. I understand that was on the Peace Sells tour.
Yes.
Back in the 80s.
Yes. Yep, exactly. It was, we were touring through Houston, and Hellstar was on the dates with us, and I remember these five little short guys all jumping off their motorhome, coming out going, hey, big guy, what's happened? And me too. It was really funny. We'll never forget it. But hey, big guy became our term of endearment with Hellstar. But, you know, they were cool, man. They were like these five little dudes, and they were all had their stretch jeans and their white high tops, and they were totally, not really thrash metal. I mean, we were playing thrash. Hellstar had a little more of a, you know, kind of maybe more of a power metal vibe to it. But, you know, it's back then in those days, you know, until bands became a national touring act, they certainly represented regions. I mean, even Pantera wasn't a national band, and I would see them in the magazines representing Texas. And obviously Texas is almost like a country in and of itself, just due to its sheer size. And Hellstar was very much the same thing, you know, and of course being on Combat Records, we knew of them, and then moving to Metal Blade. And then like James had just said, fast forward a bunch of years, Megadeth had just wrapped up the Countdown to Extinction tour. And I had a little bit of time off in late 1993. And I was living in Los Angeles. It was before I moved out to Arizona, where I live now. And we went in the studio, and I produced five songs for them, and was really a great experience. It was a lot of fun. I forgot his last name.
Floyd.
Joe. He was in.
Joe.
Yeah, Floyd. Yeah, Joe Floyd. Yeah, yeah. Because Joe Holmes was the guitar player in Ozzy. Joe Floyd. Exactly. He had a group called Warrior, which was, you know, popular in L.A. and a little bit of a, you know, some national buzz. But Joe was cool. Actually, a friend of Nick Menza's. That's how I first heard of Joe Floyd. And so we were in the studio working on this EP, and then really nothing much more came of it. I mean, it kind of went silent there for a while, as I think, like James had just said, looking for a way to release it. And then I guess, yeah, 1995 is when it actually had come out as, I think, part of a bigger full-length record, but the five tracks that we did together were included on that. And James and I remained friends, and, yeah, Joe Troutman is a, you know, mutual friend of ours. He's a promoter over in the San Diego area. So, you know, Joe's a guy who likes to bring people together for all things metal, and you know, that's yeah, what really brought him into the EMP thing. And that, you know, the new track, it's funny, you know, Black Cathedral, I listen to it all the time. Terrific track, and I think it really you know, really, I think, signifies, you know, the current state of Hellstar sound, which is the same Hellstar sound that we all like and have fallen in love with. And but just, you know, it's really a great forward motion. And that, I think, what got me and my label partner Tom excited about it is it's, you know, it's great. I mean, want to be a fan of the things we sign as well, you know, because, you know, making money in the business is so hard. You know, back in the day, I think, you know, record companies, you know, threw out loads of money because there was a lot of money to be made. And I think in this case, you know, there's just kind of a personal candor that we have with this, with Hellstar, where we want to, you know, really see this done right. SPV is the distributor for us over in Europe, and E1 here are in North America. So, you know, seems like it should be a good fit.
Yeah, totally. Nice. Yeah. You know, it's funny, me and Dave just totally, because I guess we're talking about Hellstar so much, we just totally spaced out on the one big thing that we did even more as brothers was when we did this Killing Machine project. And so there's another piece of the history that was missing that, you know, kept us in relationships all for a while. And that was such a great project, as it was Dave and Jimmy. So, and that was all put together by our good friend, Peter Schatier, who is German-French guy. And I don't know where he's at now, but I know he's always got little things going on. But that was also a nice, a killer episode in, you know, in mine and Dave's, I guess, memory book.
Dave, I know you got a few more minutes here. We got a couple things on you and some Megadeth. Well, now we'll get to that. But EMP, why did you start EMP with Tom and kind of how did that all come about? And you obviously you're in a couple of other things. You got the coffee thing as well. And
yeah, I mean, the record company thing started. I produced this terrific little all-female group out of Arizona called Dollskin. And they're teenage girls and just really, you know, it's... James will probably attest to this too. You know, we're in and around music and the business so much that, you know, it's awesome when something comes across your radar that inspires you and gets you excited. And that's what I found with these with Dollskin. They're, you know, they kind of remind me of this old school kind of punk rock thing.
Okay.
So anyway, I took them in the studio and produced their record. And because they're young, people in the industry, you know, they get hesitant to work with that because you know, just it's a timeline to develop something. So I initially put the record out through Megaforce. They worked the first single, and then the second single, you know, we wanted to turn the corner to 2016. We were just getting started. Hey, James, mute your microphone, brother.
Oh,
we're hearing you come through. But yeah, as we turned the corner in 2016, you know, I really needed another level with that record because we were just getting started with it. And Tom and I, you know, Tom has been in the business a long time on the label side of it. And so he helped me put together the E1 deal, which then led to, you know, SPV being the European partner on that. And so kind of out of, you know, really out of necessity to just keep this Dollskin record moving forward, the label formed. And I wanted to call it EMP Label Group because I don't want it to be specific only to metal music because I have a lot of other interests of just, you know, musical things. And I learned actually being on Capitol and EMI years back that, you know, they had many other sort of little sub labels. You know, they had Blue Note, which was a jazz label. And, you know, I felt that, you know, if we call it EMP Label Group, it'll allow us to be able to release a variety of different genres. Obviously, metal is kind of a passion for us, but so we have EMP Underground now for the really heavier stuff. Most of the artists on EMP, quite honestly, are more mainstream, like Apollo Under Fire record just came out, and then The Lost Year just came out, and those are kind of more kind of active rock, modern rock records. Dollskin is a sort of kind of pop punk kind of thing. See Hellstar, you know, and is very much obviously a power metal record. So, you know, the label thing kind of took on a life of its own and has become, you know, Tom, you know, is really, I've deemed him the, you know, the operations manager of it because there's a lot that goes with it, but between managing the staff of publicity and radio, street teams and all, you know, there's a lot of different departments, so to speak, inside of a label, and they need to be run properly. And obviously I'm on the road touring and, you know, Megadeth is my main, focus, you know, this year now with this new record out. So, you know, but I'm in the loop on everything and it's very much we sign things based on, a team, you know, obviously things that hopefully we like, but things that we think, you know, are going to be, profitable not only for the label but just importantly for the artist, because I think for me as a label guy, I look at the label through the eyes of an artist, you know, and I think that's sure. One thing I've always done is I'm I'm like, look, if I don't, first of all, I've had no interest in ever having a label. But now that I have one, my interest is to be on the interest of the artist. And, you know, because I think, you know, years ago when James and I were signing record deals, you know, those record deals we signed, they couldn't care less about us. You know, it's kind of like today's version of Spotify. They use our music and they build their brand on the backs of our music and our creative efforts. And while I can't save the day for the music business, I can at least do my little part in making sure that everybody gets treated fairly and that the interests of the artist's music get put out there in a way that I hope will be beneficial to everybody.
Right on. Yeah, and just to let you know, Venom Radio, we do pay royalties, we're licensed, we're all legal. There's a lot of internet radio stations that seem to want to skip that, which is a problem, because when they screw off, you know, everybody gets put in the spotlight, you know. So,
well, there comes this point, you know, when you're building something early on, you know, you kind of need to be, you know, you kind of have to sacrifice sometimes money and payment in lieu of building your brand and your awareness, you know. Sure. So it's not to say that some artists shouldn't do these things, but there does come a certain point. I mean, I remember showing my daughter my BMI statement, and because she was listening to Spotify all the time, and I said, listen, I want you to see what I get paid, you know, from Spotify, and what I get paid pays our bills around here. And I showed her what I got paid from, like, terrestrial radio, ringtones, Megadeth songs being played on an airplane, you know, Sirius radio. And then I said, here's what I get paid from Spotify. And I mean, it was something like 130,000 plays, and I think I got $1.03 or something, you know. So
ouch.
So yeah,
don't ask for that new laptop or that new phone you've been wanting, you know.
Exactly. When I see Taylor Swift pull her music off of those sources, I'm like, go girl, go. You know, I mean, she can afford to. Not everybody can. She can afford to. And it's, you know, again, it's like years ago when Metallica fought Napster. It's like they were absolutely 100% right in doing so. And they got so much bad press over it because everyone's like, oh, Metallica's rich and screw them and da-da-da-da-da. But look, did they not predict the future of what was going to happen? And, you know, there were many years there where everybody just thought, you know, it's the Wild West. We can have whatever we want just because we want it. And music should be all about the fans and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, I'd say one thing. It costs somebody a lot of time and money to record it and make it and produce it and put it out. And if nothing else, those people should be paid, you know. And I think we've transitioned through that, and I think we're on the other side of it. But, you know, Steve Jobs, I think, probably single-handedly did more for the music business by forming iTunes, even if it was just to have a store so he could sell more iPods. He at least got, you know, he understood Hollywood, he understood the music business, and he at least put together a method by which to harness, you know, this Wild West thing and at least, you know, get everybody thinking like, yeah, music is not free, man. I mean, it's, why should James and I sit around and work our tails off and create something that everybody just takes for their own enjoyment, you know? And look, first and foremost, we want people to enjoy it, but there is a reality that you know, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I always grew up buying records and cassettes and CDs and stuff, and I buy everything off of the internet. In fact, every record that EMP puts out, I go on iTunes and I actually buy a copy for myself. I don't just take the master and stick it in my iPhone. I wait for us to release it, and then I go buy it. I support the cause. And I do the same with every Megadeth record. I go personally. As much as a record company sends them to me, I personally go buy them from iTunes to support our own cause.
You mentioned the new Megadeth album, Dystopia. I know you got to run. You got a few more minutes?
I do. A couple minutes, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, the new album, Dystopia, very killer. Good job on that. And I actually had one of my buddies, I told one guy I was doing this interview, and he's like, oh, you got to ask Dave this question.
G'day, Dave. This is Mean Paul Waste. Just wanted to ask you, when recording in the studio, do you use a DI, direct input, into the console, or do you mic up your bass cabinets, or do you do both? Cheers.
recording is a whole science unto itself. Yeah, I mean the answer is I use both. I use a microphone and a direct. You know, with Dystopia in particular, we used a method very similar to what we did on Count or on Cryptic Writings, which we also recorded our first record we recorded in Nashville, where we built a tone. You know, I had I think three or four different amplifiers plus some direct inputs, and I did the same thing with Dystopia. I think we had three or four amps. We had a direct pedal. We had a clean direct. And so this way, when you're mixing, you have all these different varieties of tones to mix, you know, so that you don't just have to choose one or the other. And, you know, the Megadeth music has a lot of complexities to it. And the guitar and drum tones get pretty big around it. So I like to have a nice variety to choose from in the mix.
Okay, talking about Vampiro, it's your 9th studio album, correct?
Yeah, I've lost track, dude. Yeah. So let's see, studio album. Yeah, see that. So that's, I guess you're right. Shit. I don't even know now. I'd have to count them out, but let's see. Okay. The four classics, then there's multiples. And then, because the stuff that came out before was not, then there's seed, Sins, King of Hell, Glory of Chaos, Wicked Nest. No, it's our 10th.
Okay.
It's 10th album.
To be honest, I went on Wikipedia and looked up, and I got 9th actual and then 12th or 13th overall, I think. But
yeah, some things were some things are re-released, you know, with, you know, special packaging, and some were live albums, and I think it's even more than that. I think it's a total of probably about 13 or 14, somewhere around there, right.
And Vampiro is coming out on the 15th of July 2016 on EMP.
Well, that's going to be the pre-order date.
So pre-order of the 15th, and when is the album actually going to be in stores or available on iTunes and Amazon and all that?
And then the street date for it is August 28th.
Are all the members of Hellstar in Houston, in that area?
Yeah, well, you know, we're all in Houston, yeah. Yeah, but it just, Houston's such a big city. We don't live near each other, but yeah, we're all from the Houston area.
Okay. How does the writing process for that album go? I mean, do you guys do the typical thing where, you know, you guys get together and write it, or is it because you're maybe a little bit more spread out and, you know, jobs, family, other things, you guys kind of, you know, record tracks and then compile all that in the actual recording evolution when you guys all get together?
Well, we don't really do any of that anymore. I mean, we don't even rehearse for an album. We just start writing separately, and then we start sending ideas, you know, for each piece of music that's written. The drummer has his own studio at home, so he can do everything he needs to do there. And then it's all sent over to Larry's house, where the main studio is, where we were actually really, you know, where everything was tracked. And then we just record, you know, that's what took so long, is that we would go to Larry's and record the tracks, and Mikey would record the drums, but he'd have to send them so Larry could still edit everything. But yeah, I mean, that's how we did everything. We would just come up with either, Larry would either come up with riffs, or so would Andrew, and I would come up with lyrics and melodies, and we would go, when we had what we thought was going to be the next song, then, you know, I'd go over there and start laying down the vocals. So, and I would stay like for the whole weekend at Larry's and then come back. That's the part of the reason, is because we live so far apart. I mean, Houston is huge. I mean, you know, so you can take an hour and a half from one end of Houston to the other easy. So no different than going from San Diego to LA in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of how we did everything. And then once everything was completely done and recorded there, you know, I mean, all the way down to the last bells and whistles, then it gets sent over via, wave files to Bill to mix, Bill Metoyer to mix the record, and then he does his magic over there and then mixed it and mastered it, and then it's done.
Cool. Okay, any upcoming tours for Hellstar?
Yeah, we're actually going to be doing quite a few shows. We were gonna do a full-on scale East Coast tour, like, you know, just a straight 2 weeks of being out, but instead we're gonna switch it around to just kind of hitting the markets that were actually offering the better money, obviously, because that means those are going to be the better shows. So we're going to kind of do everything more. We're going to kind of stick to, I hate to use that word, but in a sense, it, you know, see if we can go ahead and stick to this weekend warrior thing for a while, for at least for the rest of this year, because of the fact that with so many years of retirement for the rest of the band, not me, I mean, it's funny because there's always got to be one cockroach that's got to be surviving the nuclear war of the hell of everything that goes on. And unfortunately for me, I never gave up. I stayed in the rat race while those guys went off and got killer IT jobs, you know, in like 90, 91. And so they had all these years to accumulate a relationship with a great job and high-paying jobs. They all developed families and bought homes and everything else that comes along with the American dream. And then once they came out of retirement to go back out and do what we're doing now, well, they're all on paid vacation time, you know. So it don't matter one way or the other whether we sell one shirt or 100 at the end of the day. So it's me that's kind of stuck through with the full-on musician life, which bear in mind too, for the young listeners out there that are thinking that, oh, you know, I'm going to put a band together and I'm going to do this and I'm going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, the chances of you really becoming very successful and making it in this business is you're better off just hoping on the lottery. That's the reality of it. So yeah. It is smart to, you know, and it's not to say, oh, you know, that here, let me crush all your dreams, but no, I mean, there, you know, it's okay to gamble once in a while, but I, you know, my suggestion to any young band out there is stick through your school and your education and at least try to get some good degree, which doesn't take that long anymore in college, to have something to fall on. Then go ahead and spin your wheels for about 10 years. And if you don't make it, if you don't make it in 10 years, you're not going to make it ever. And that's the other thing. And the other thing, I'd even say more realistic, if you don't make it within the first 5 years, you're never going to make it. It's very rare that bands have been doing it for so long and all of a sudden they become billion-dollar blockbuster artists on TV and everywhere else. It's, you know, it's usually going to, when it happens, it's going to happen quick. And then that way, you know, you've invested 10 years into really trying this. And if you went to college like right away after high school and didn't waste time, didn't dick around and stayed focused with, you know, you have to do something for your future. you'd be 30, 31, 32 by that time and go, well, it didn't work out. And now I'm still young enough to go get a decent career and I'll be able to work doing that forever. And then one day I'll be working enough years so I can retire. And then maybe when I retire, I can go back to playing something, who knows, you know, but that's my reality point of the music business these days. So I am bitter about it because, you know, here I am, you know, half a century old now, and it's too late for me to go back to school and go, well, let me invest 5 years into something. Who the hell's going to hire me? You know, so I'm stuck doing what I got to do forever. So that's the big joke, which is kind of, it's not a bad thing. It's just that, you know, I'm basically going to die with a microphone in my hand. And little Joe can tell you, I joke about it all the time. I go, well, when, you know, I probably do metal, very strongly and decently probably for another 15 years, if not more, you know, maybe let's push it, say 20. And if I do live a nice, healthy life, say I'd live to be 100. Well, hey, then after that, I wouldn't keep doing metal if I couldn't do it right anymore. And then I've always loved Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck and, martini bar music, then I'll just jump that ship and put on a tuxedo and get a gig on a cruise ship and sing to old ladies and stuff like that. And, you know, that's my plan.
Well, the thing is, you got a plan.
I got a plan. I think, right. I got a plan. And
I think
probably make more money than I ever did in my whole life if I jumped on that ship now, you know, which I've thought about it sometimes, like, dude, go to the men's warehouse, buy a fucking tuxedo and stop fucking worrying about being poor. Go do that now. You know.
Right on. No, I think that's something that I've heard from you know, a lot of people in that, and it seems like you know, some people call it luck. Other people call it right place at the right time, yeah. Which to me is luck.
Right.
I know there's one band in particular from Australia that I really like, and called King Parrot, and they're really heavy grindy stuff. But they've been absolutely fucking relentless on the road the last 2 years. I mean, I think those guys have had off about 4 months total of like not playing a show, you know, in that time. And they're really doing it. I mean, will a band like that, even if they are touring the States, I think this is their fourth or fifth tour in the States now and touring Europe. They're going back there for the, you know, third time. They're doing it, but will they be able to, you know, get to maybe David's level? I don't know. The style of music is different. It's more of a, you know, underground type of thing. And you know, from being in music for 35 years or more, that, that sometimes genres have, you know, some genres are more the big stage and some genres are more staying in the, club's underground scene.
Yeah.
So it's hard. You got to be smart about it. And you got to have a backup plan. You know, that's definitely key.
Yep.
Okay. Then real quick, one last question. David touched on it. It was about the internet and whatnot, because this is an internet show. Do you have any comments as far as that whole deal goes with the, you know, downloading music, whether... You know,
yeah, whatever. Well, I mean, really, there's probably not an answer I could give you that was more accurate than his. So it's like, why repeat it again, you know? So it's kind of, that's basically this. Yeah, I mean, that's my viewpoint of it all as well, you know? I mean, it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, we're losing a lot of money as artists. But at the same time, you're getting a lot more, that's hard, you know, I hate to use the word promotion, but that's, you are getting a sense of promotion, you know, although it's none of it's coming back to you in a monetary way, but you're, at least people are starting to find out who you are more now. And, you know, so it has its benefits, I guess, you know, it would be okay if the fact that you're getting promotion out of it, you know, and more people are finding out about you because the internet is the internet, you know, and mm-hmm. it led to almost a for sure situation, whereas when you start coming through towns, whereas before when a promoter would only pay you so much because they realistically feel that, you know, you're only going to draw so much. That's usually how, you know, when a band's going out on the road and stuff, that's how usually your salary is based. If they were to, you know, be able to throw in, yeah, but that was before the internet when you booked us the last time. Now the internet's out, so we'll probably have maybe 50 more people at the show. If it worked that way and it meant you getting paid more for your live performances, because now the expectancy of your turnouts will be a little bigger, because back then not too many people knew about you, but now they do, then it might have its rewards, but that's not the case. So yeah, it's like I said, it's a double-edged sword, and you know, that's about the best thing I can describe of, you know, how I feel about all of it.
Right on. All right, fair enough. Well, thanks for the interview, James.
Yeah, no problem, buddy.
Again, a big shout out to Joe Troutman,
yeah,
in San Diego, that got me hooked up with you guys. I really appreciate the time.
Yeah, you got it, man.